All right, so in chapter 34 then, or lesson 34 in the book on page 137, we have the beginning of the lesson on the rise of the Persians. And Mickey told me that last time he had gotten down here to about chart 19 on the charts that he had been going through. All right, once again, a reminder of where we are and where we're looking at. So as we look at the map of the Western Hemisphere, we see that we, of course, are here in Southern California, and we're going to zoom in on our building right there. We just want to remember that as we've zoomed in here on the Western Hemisphere and on the West Coast, that the lands that we're talking about are much further removed from where we are. That as we look at the area which I've called Assyria and Babylon, we see that we go halfway across the world, literally. And we are at about the same latitude, however, as generally speaking, as these folks are. And so the area that we're talking about now, of course, is all the way from, we can't see the Indus River out here, but from India all the way over here to Greece and down into Egypt and somewhat over into Libya and such alike as that, when we consider the Medo-Persian Empire that we're talking about in this particular lesson. And as a matter of fact, if we go to our lesson and look at this, we see that this is the extent of the Medo-Persian Empire, way over here to the Indus River, all the way down to the Arabian Sea and Persian Gulf, and then down into and including Egypt and Libya. The conquering of Egypt did not last for many people very long at all. Apparently, Egypt was a pretty strong power. They didn't have a lot of occupiers for a long time. They did have the Medes and the Persians were able to take care of that. This part of history, of course, as Mickey says, is very fascinating to him. Fascinating to me also, as I've been reading occasionally excerpts through a book of a person who obviously doesn't believe in the inspiration of the Bible, but Cyrus Gordon's book, The Ancient Near East, is an excellent book on this area here, because in his first iteration of this book, he called it Old Testament History. But he decided for popularity's sake, I guess, to rename it The Ancient Near East. But he makes statements in there like when it says that when they're talking in the book of Daniel to King Belshazzar, and they mentioned that Nebuchadnezzar was his father, he says, well, that's a mistake from the copyists and the people, and the people that wrote this book of Daniel, who he thinks is two or three different people anyway. not realizing, of course, that many people are called father who are not father and who are not even related many ways that we look at people from time to time. So I could call someone my father who's not my father simply because he was of that nature to me, or he was a person that was of great consequence in my life in that sort of instance. So anyway, you'll remember the movie a number of years ago called The 300, or 300 I guess it was called, which apparently is sort of is fictional, but it's based on a battle that took place over here somewhere, I forget, right in here somewhere in the Aegean Sea, where the Persians were battling the Greeks, actually battling, in this particular instance, the Spartans. And this, it is supposed, was actually, I believe it was Cambyses II, who was the Ahasuerus of Queen Esther. I think the thing that's interesting to note is that since we're focusing on Israel and what's going on with the Israelites, we have a tendency, to a large extent, to ignore world history in all of this. And I think we need to realize that as far as the Assyrians and the Babylonians and the Medes and the Persians were concerned, Israel was just a tiny pain in the neck that needed to be taken care of, that they could and did wipe out at will. But we need to remember also that God wiped out a good portion of the Assyrian army when 185,000 of them woke up dead one morning. The thing is that God has his hand in this, and we need to remember that he has his plan for Judah, I mean for Israel. But we see in the book of Daniel, what is the point that God's trying to make to the kings and things there in the book of Daniel? Yeah, God rules in the kingdoms of men, right? As a matter of fact, that's said a number of times in the book of Daniel. So, anyway, as the folks in Judah were taken away up here into Babylonian captivity, we realize that they were there for, the people that were there the longest were there for how many years? 70. were there for 70 years. The first one's taken around 606 B.C., And then 89 was the second one, and 586, I think it was the temple or the city destroyed? 586, okay, yeah. All right. So some of the people weren't there for 70 years, but the people that were there that were taken away in the 606 capture, they were there for the entire 70 years. But what did that do as far as the kingdoms go? What kingdoms did these people then live under? They were certainly taken away by the Babylonians, but was there a transition there at one time? Yeah. What did they do? Right. So Darius the Mede from down in here somewhere came over and walked into Babylon began the start of what later became known as the Medo-Persian Empire. So these people were under the rule or under the authority of two different empires and a number of different kings. So when they were first taken away in 606 B.C., they're under the authority of who? What king? Nebuchadnezzar. And then later on, as we go by, we see, I think, there were probably four kings in that time, because I think Belshazzar was the last one when Darius walked in and took over the kingdom. And I think Belshazzar was the fourth one in that line. I'm not positive about that, but I think that's the case. So a number of kings there, and then Darius comes in and takes over, and then, I don't know, two or three kings later is Cyrus II, is the king that is a very liberal king. And at that time, what does Cyrus decide that should happen to all of the captives, not just the people from Israel? Go back to their homelands if they want to. As a matter of fact, he was so liberal about that he allowed them to have money and goods and things like that, and they could take from the people that were there who would give to them. So it's interesting to see the difference between the Assyrians, who were very cruel in the way that they treated their captives, to the Babylonians, who were sort of we just put them in other cities and we'll just leave them there to do what they do. And then the Cyrus of the Medo-Persian Empire says, well, you can go back home if you want to. So some, but perhaps not all, did. I think we need to realize that those people that were taken away into Assyrian captivity and then those people that were taken away into Babylonian captivity were there for a total of 200 years. These lands to which they'd been taken away now were their homes, had been their homes for generations. So it's much like, I think, what the people that are Jews today thought about the division of the Palestinian lands after World War II. They said, oh, now we can go home. And you go, what? No, that's not your home. Number one, very difficult to tell who you are anyway. And number two, it's not your home. And it was taken away by God. But anyway, this definitely down here was their home. Of course, we're getting into a bit of the return now. We don't want to do that too much. But we realize that the people came back here. They had a much smaller kingdom, you might say, even though actually they didn't even have a kingdom because they didn't have a king. So they had a much, much smaller, you know, political boundaries and things like that. And so when they came back, things were much smaller and were ruled by other people at that time, which made it kind of strange when the scribes and the Pharisees were talking to Jesus and said, we've been under bondage to no man. They've been under bondage for hundreds and hundreds of years. And they say that they're not under bondage to any man. So, now, oh, I didn't print these off. But no doubt, everybody, yes? Right. Yeah, anybody who read it. Yeah. The only insight you might say that I might have to that is that they're saying that they are not physically the slaves of anybody right now. So
yeah, right now
they said we have never. The word never is the Yeah. Yeah, I think I have a feeling that the people that were speaking were not speaking about necessarily about their nation, though that's really the way it should have they should have taken it, but we're saying, well, I'm not anybody's slave or indentured servant or anything like that. We've never been that way. We've always been a free people. I don't know. It's very strange. As many of the sayings that they had to say back then were a bit on the strange side, I think. Where did you come to this conclusion?
Yeah, from Egypt up to present, there's multiple examples of them being exactly that.
Exactly. Yep. Yep. All right. Now, I was going to print these out before class, and then I didn't. So we'll just go through them bit by bit. I, of course, sent you via email, those of you that I have email addresses for, these particular questions. And I also sent you the answer sheet so that you could cheat and look at the answers. So those are there. But let's just, as we talk about the rise of the Persians, the thing is that as we look at the lesson book on page 130, oh good, I just turned my computer off. Isn't that nice? Stupid machine. on 137, we realize that the I hate computers. We realize that they're talking here about the fact that there was a constant sort of battle going on in this area that we've looked at here, this one right here, as to who was going to be the ruler of the area. And the Assyrians kind of, as we know, were taken over by the Babylonians. The Babylonians, of course, started off being just a little kingdom down here. Did you all discuss what provoked them to attack the Assyrians? There were a number of things that were going on at these particular times. And one of the things that happened, and I'm not sure it's what provoked the Babylonians to attack the Assyrians for sure, but it was something that that caused some of the Babylonian people to sides to change hands, is that there was a lot of religious debate and a religious battle going on as to what particular god or idol these people were going to worship. And so a lot of times what the kingdoms did was that they fought one another because, oh, you know, I don't believe in Molech, and I believe in, you know, the sun god or something like that. And so there was these big pitched battles and things to determine which god was the one that was going to rule or reign. David? Yeah.
Conquered, and they'd leave people at the places they conquered. It wasn't like they would, like the Syrians or the Persians did, and the,
Okay, right.
They had to leave people there. They would displace people so that they had a little different situation than some of the other people.
Yeah, they had satraps or governors and all around and taking care of things. It's interesting to note, and I think I noticed it in the book of Ezra, when it talks about that Ezra or Nehemiah, one or the other, when they were going down, it says it tells what day they left and what month they left Babylon, and it tells what month and what day they got to Israel. Anybody remember how long that was? It was at least a month. certainly, it was. You know, it's not something somebody could do in a couple of days. I mean, they had to go from all the way up here, and where were they? There's Susa, Babylon. They were somewhere in this area, generally speaking, on the Euphrates River. They had to come all the way around here and down there. I thought it was a month, but it's been several weeks since I read that particular passage. So, yeah, so a slow caravan, that's for sure. They had to, you know, the cattle and the babies and the things like that had to keep up and things like that. But it was not an easy walk in the park, as it were. And so when we look at kingdoms like this, I mean, this is just huge. And if we if we go back here to Google Earth and just look at the image that we're looking at right there, which is roughly equivalent to what that is, and just back out and look at Europe or Asia or something like that. But we look at the empire that they had, which went all the way about down to here and around and down there. That takes up all of Europe, part of Asia. That's a huge kingdom. And they had, you know, their modems were only 300 baud at that time, so their email would go really slow. So, you know, if the king, who was nominally in this area somewhere, wanted to get a message down to one of his governors down toward Egypt, even riding the Pony Express, you know, it'd probably take a week to get there. You know, killing one horse to get to the next horse, and then jumping on that one and going. So the length of communication and the logistics that were required to hold together an empire of that size in what we might say of that primitive culture, it was just amazing. And yes, we might say that yes, this was the Medo-Persian Empire, but it was more like the Medo-Persian conglomeration. I mean, it was, you know, sometime, you know, this part would fall off because, what was it, this little place over, this area over here was called Lydia, and it decided that it wanted to be, you know, sort of more united with Greece than it wanted to be united with those scumbag Persians from down over here. So they decided that, well, we'll just, you know, rebel. Well, it would take them weeks to get an army out there. You know, they might have some local gendarmes there, but not a whole lot. just thinking about the logistics that would be required in these days to take care of a kingdom of that size, it's just amazing to imagine what it would be like. We have seen a lot of stories, as it were, popularly from things that take place in this particular region, part of time, and especially that movie, The 300. And we realize that a lot of important history took place in this area here that was not just related to the Israelites, but had to do with world history at that time, because really, this was essentially the world at that time. It was the what they would call the civilized world at that time. Though I'm sure that the people that were up there in Europe didn't think much about that. All right, if we go back here to the slides that Mickey has put together. I think there was a comment that was made. I don't remember whether it was in the lesson book or where. But I noticed that our lesson, when we actually look at it, only has a page and a half of text. Everything else is maps. It must be in the secular history book that I was reading. It talks about the fact that in Isaiah 44:28 through 45:1 that Mickey has quoted here, that talks about Cyrus being my shepherd, and also saying, thus says the Lord to his anointed, to Cyrus, whose right hand I have held. And as a matter of fact, it's in this book here by Cyrus Gordon. He points out that this is one of the few places where the Hebrew word Messiah is used in relationship to someone not the Messiah that's going to come to save Israel. But it's a word that I wouldn't say is in common usage, but one that was used for other meanings other than just the person who would come to save Israel. But apparently the root word for this one down here where it says, thus says the Lord to his anointed, to Cyrus, the word there is Messiah, the English version of the Hebrew word. And so that's much like Juan, who was it, the other king that he said that he's my, it was Nebuchadnezzar, right? That he said, this is my servant, right? Yeah. So you'll remember back in the Babylonian Empire, he referred to Nebuchadnezzar as my servant. And here, later on, as Isaiah is talking about the people, he calls Cyrus the anointed of the Lord. I think that's particularly important for us to realize. And if he calls Nebuchadnezzar my servant, and if he calls Cyrus his anointed, once again, what is God trying to point out here? He's in charge. Yeah. God's in control, and that's the reason why he says this. All right, so, and I think this is where we're talking about in Isaiah 44, was written 200 years before Cyrus came along, and I think the important thing that Mickey was trying to point out here is that Cyrus is mentioned a couple of times here sometime before he was even born. And so Isaiah says that Cyrus then will be his shepherd and his anointed, and this happens even before Cyrus was born. Juan. Yeah, I think that's what Mickey's got on the next slide. As a matter of fact, biblical critics have tried to say for years that all of these books were written after they happened anyway. You know, they just went back and made up prophecies as they went along. It really doesn't fit biblically when you look at things. They tried to prove that chapters 40 through 66 were written by someone who was unknown, by some unknown writer during the captivity. And they claimed that no man could have made such predictions by his own power. And so they must have been written 200 years later and then made to look like it happened 200 years earlier. That doesn't fit with what goes on in other portions of the books, especially in the book of Isaiah. As a matter of fact, there is the Dead Sea Scrolls? I think the Dead Sea Scrolls. They have one called the Isaiah Scroll. And I think it's an almost complete rendition of the book of Isaiah. And obviously it's from much later than when it was originally written. But the thing is that manuscripts and pieces of manuscripts that continue to come up in the days that go along here continue to prove out that the text of the Bible that we have now is the text that was originally written. And so we look at, for example, the King James Version of the Bible and realize that it was based on a text that was extremely late. I mean, like in the, 1200 A.D. or something like that? That's what they used for the text. And it was the Textus Receptus, which I think was a translation into Hebrew and Greek from the Latin, which meant that it had to be translated into the Latin from something else earlier on. And so it was really permuted there. And so later on then, you would think that as more and more things are found, the Dead Sea Scrolls are found, other manuscripts are found here and there, you would think there'd be all sorts of errors between that and what those earlier texts than what was used to translate the King James Version, for example, had. And we find out that that's not the case at all. That the scriptures that we have are incredibly reliable. You might say unbelievably reliable if you were a person that didn't believe in God. And that the mistakes that supposedly are in the Bible are such that they're either inconsequential or are not indeed mistakes at all. Much like this guy Gordon says about, well, how could you call Nebuchadnezzar your father? Well, of course you can call him his father. He was the king three guys before me, so he was my father, whether he was related to me or not. Joey?
Yeah, I think I read somewhere that when someone did an actual comparison of the Dead Sea Scrolls to the text we have today, that the only so-called discrepancies were in one spot said holy, holy, and the other spot said holy, holy, holy. Or
yeah. Right.
So you can logically reason that can't be the case. Otherwise, we're not responsible for what God has revealed because it's not accurate. So you have to believe by faith that God will guard the integrity of His word throughout the ages.
Yes. Yes. And there's so many evidence. And the thing is when you start looking at the evidence for the Bible, we realize that there are thousands and thousands, literally, of manuscripts and fragments and such like of biblical writings from both the Old and the New Testament, and that they attest to what has been written in the past and now so well that it's just incredible to believe. Yet there are, who was it? It's one of the great philosophers of Greek time, Aristotle or Plato, something like that. Anyway, there is only one manuscript of his works extant in the world today, and it's from a fairly late date. Yet nobody doubts that Plato said these things, or Aristotle, or whomever it is. Yet when it comes down to the Bible, we've got a gazillion different manuscripts and fragments and this and that and the other thing, and people say, well, I don't know if this word is the right word to use. Yeah, one of the manuscripts said holy, holy, and the other one said holy, holy, holy. You know, how can you believe it? They go, okay, maybe the guy got tired of writing holy. You know? And and really, certainly we don't want to get into the study of how we got the Bible today, but you know, we went through in the younger people's class a book about this size of how we got the Bible, and went through it fully and looked at a lot of things and realized, yeah, certainly there are a certain amount of things that one might say, well, you know, what did he do here? And you say, well, yeah, it looks like a copyist was trying to make things look right by putting this phraseology in here when it's actually up there already. So he felt that, you know, this helpful guy, the same guy that took one of the manuscripts, was it? I don't know, Rachel, whether you remember or not, that he wrote over one of the manuscripts. Right. So one of the scribes had this really, really old manuscript, and he was trying to help things along in preserving this thing, and so he traced over what was there and ended up sort of mutilating the manuscript in such a way that it wasn't really valuable or useful anymore. They go, eh, stop with the helping already. So, but, you know, if you see some of the stories about how the Bible was copied, for example, you would see that they would have these scriptoriums where people did copying, and one person would read, and he would read like three words or four words or a line or something like that. And apparently there was a number at the end of that line that would tell them how many letters, and each letter was like assigned a value. And so this line needed to add up to 37. That line needed to add up to 24. And if it didn't, there was something wrong.
We do the exact same thing today with file transfers. We call
it checksum. Yes, checksum. That's right.
And so they had that concept back then to guard the integrity of the
word. Oh, Juan, does that address your comment at all? Right.
And this is where he's going to be born. This is exactly what's going to be done.
Yeah.
If anybody were to go back to make it look even more believable, wouldn't you be pretty much saying everything that you could possibly say about that? Like you say, yesterday all this happened, and you would be as precise as possible. So that way it made it seem like, oh, you were really on. Why would they be vague in prophesizing backwards?
Right. Yeah, if they were trying to fake it. Yeah, they would say, well, Cyrus is going to be born on April 22nd of 467 BC, and he's going to be born at such and such, and he's on such a street, at address in such and such a town. You know, that would make it seem a whole lot more, you know, miraculous than saying Cyrus. John. Oh yeah, right. Yeah, and in our study of how we got the Bible, I don't believe that we read about anybody saying somebody put up his hands in a great hue and cry, saying that there's been a big plot to change 47 chapters in the middle of, you know, the book of Proverbs or something like that. so there's really been none of that, except from people who are atheists that want to discount the entire Bible anyway. But Joey. Right.
He failed.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. If we don't have what God wanted us to have, then he failed in his duty. In what he said he would do to us, and we shouldn't and can't believe any of it. John. Okay. Yeah, we have more than, what do you call it? Blind faith. There's a lot of proof and a lot of evidence, both within the Bible itself, mostly, but extra-biblically also, that shows us that these things were true. You know, it was there was a discussion a number of years ago back, I think it was before the Dead Sea Scrolls were discovered in 1947-8, when you go down the number, the names of the tribes that the people are going to conquer when they enter the land, we can't find this tribe. We've never found it. No, we can't. I don't know. 50 years later, they dug him up, and there it was. They go, oh, well, okay, check that one off. So, oh yeah. Is that the one that's up north here?
Yeah.
Yeah. Up in here somewhere, I think. Right. Oh, okay. Up in
huge kingdom at one time. found out that, in fact, they found the spelling that helped them because it had Phoenician, I think, was the other language on the stone, and then they ended up being able to translate.
Okay, yeah. That wasn't the big one that
No, it wasn't the big one, so it was kind of like that.
Right.
Phoenician had two languages other than Hittite. First, I thought the Hittite was the decoration.
Oh, decorative language, yeah. Okay. So, anyway, the Bible has been proven time and time again, yet so there's so many people that don't want to accept it, yet, what is it? Nobody's ever proved who Shakespeare is, right? A lot of people will say, well, Shakespeare wasn't really a guy. It was a bunch of people. You know, it's like they talk about the writers of the Pentateuch. They actually assign them letters, and there's four different letters as to whether this person was the Yahwist, the Elohimist. There's like four different terms that they use, and they say that you can break up the Pentateuch into these different sections, and you can say it was written by the Yahwehist writer because he liked to use the word Yahweh a lot, and this other person, the Elohimist, he liked to use the word Elohim more frequently. And so you can see that there's a difference here. And so, but the thing is that when we read through the Bible, we don't find that we've got some herky-jerky writing here that we can't figure out, that it seems like all of a sudden we went to a different writer who didn't know what was going on before. It's like giving 10 people a task to do to write this book, and they don't coordinate with one another, and each one writes his own chapter, and then you go and look through it, and without any coordination between the writers, and think, well, this doesn't flow very smoothly. And one would expect then, if we had four different compilers at different times or different ages that put these books together for the Pentateuch, for example, that we'd see a lot of misplacements and things that don't read well. You know, there's certainly we can go from one chapter to another and say, how do we get from here to there? The fact of the matter is that God didn't tell us everything that we want to know. He told us what He wanted us to know. It's kind of like in the book of Daniel, we go directly from Nebuchadnezzar to Belshazzar because God didn't feel that mentioning anything about the intervening kings was important. And so there were a number of years there where Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah and Daniel were, in charge of various important things in the kingdom of Babylon, and we don't hear anything about them. How wonderful they were or what they did or anything like that. And all of a sudden, we're at Belshazzar, and they say, by the way, Daniel, he's a great prophet. You might as well talk to him. And it's like nobody ever heard of him. Up until that time, at least as far as in Belshazzar's court went. So, God wrote things the way that He wanted them written, or caused them to be written the way that He wanted them written. And we have that, and I think that an honest study of how we got the Bible indeed shows us that that we do have what God wanted us to have. So, after that rambling, where were we? Oh, this was this was in Isaiah's prophecy, of course, which was, I didn't realize it was 200 years before. Was it 200 years before Cyrus came along? I thought it was 100 and something. But either way, excuse me? Nearly. Oh, in the book? Okay. All right. So we realized that a lot of people have been trying to disclaim the Bible and saying that there's all sorts of mistakes in it simply because there's no way that somebody could prophesy the name of somebody 200 years before he was born. Well, it happened. all right. Now, as we, the whole lesson here is entitled The Rise of the Persians, right? Yes. And as we look at this, we realize that Darius was the first king of what became the Medo-Persian Empire. It wasn't the Medo-Persian Empire when it first started out. I mean, Darius was called Darius the what? Well, he was called Darius the Great. He was also called Darius the Mede, as I recall, if I remember that correctly. But they all came together, the Medes and the Persians, at a later time, because it was much easier for them to gather together and expand the empire with a coalition of those forces than it was for the Medes to attempt to do that all by themselves. Now, the Medes were, if I recall correctly, the Medes were up here in the sort of the northern area, and the Persians, of course, were further down here in what we call today Iran, right? I think Iran is the further east one, right? Iraq's over here, right? And Iran's over here. Afghanistan's in the middle somewhere. I think. Anyway, and that's one thing that if you want to irritate somebody from Iran, just refer to them as an Arab, because they're Muslims. We have a tendency to think that all Muslims are Arab, but if you call a Persian an Arab, you'll get quite the argument out of him if you don't get something, a message from four of his fingers. Because these people down here are Persians. They speak a completely different language than these people over here in the Arabian Peninsula, and they are not Arabs. Their genetics are not Arabian. Their genetics are from this area over here, and so you'll get a large argument from them. But the thing is that these people of the Medes and these people of the Persians over here, when they got together, they were able to take care of the Babylonian Empire and expand all the way out to the way over here to the Indus River, over here to Greece, and way down into Egypt and Libya. It was just. Yes, right. Yeah, I think on Mickey's charts, he's got something about that, or had something about it in a previous chart. Let me see. I think it was. Well, that's not it. You had an arrow on here that's showing what they were doing. Yeah. I think that's what you're thinking of, David. They struck out and took off to the east, to the west first, to expand their territory as much as they could. That was before, I think, they came down here and tried expanding down to the south. I think they had gotten over here toward the Indus River fairly rapidly, though. I think mainly because the Persians owned this area down here, and so they were fairly close to the area around India and Pakistan. So they did that, yes, and they struck out for Lydia. An interesting note is that when you read about that, the battle that took place in this area in the 400s BC, that movie, The 300, was made about, we see that a lot of the people in this area were angered by what one of the kings did, because apparently there was a coalition of Lydia and a few other areas that they were all together in some sort of bond to respect a certain god or something like that. And one of the rulers here of the Medo-Persian Empire decided that he didn't like that god. And I think what it was is that, and there was, and this may be, I'm probably mixing up these things by millennia for all I know, but he went actually and took the reigning god that was in Babylon and melted it down. Yeah. And that kind of upset the people in that area.
In the 400s, didn't they have the Sekar?
Yeah.
The governors, and they kind of were in charge. They just had to back to the emperor, but they were kind of like kings in different areas.
Right.
And stuff, so they could do their own religious thing or whatever.
Right. Yeah, so they had a kind of a coalition. And as we get toward the Greek Empire later on, we realize that a lot of these people had gotten together. The Greek city-states had finally sort of merged to a certain extent, and these people had gotten together, including with the folks over here, and they were eventually able to push these people back and start with the Grecian Empire. I don't think the Grecian Empire was ever nearly as extensive as the Medo-Persian Empire. The Medo-Persian Empire was the largest empire ever in the ancient Near East. It's the extent to which it went was greater than any other empire that was there at any time, either before or after. But given the distance, and then obviously the modernization of weapons of warfare and things like that, they were able to prosecute a battle against other people more quickly and take over areas before other people could come in and back them up. All right. I doubt that I've accomplished any of the purposes that Mickey wanted me to be up here for. But anyway, Chris, I guess you're going to have the lesson on Wednesday, or what? I'll be in Ogden, Utah all next week, so I think Chris will have the lesson then, so perhaps he won't ramble quite as much as I, and we'll see how the lesson turns out then. So continue on lesson 34. If you did not get my email that had the questions for lesson 34, please see me. Either give me an email address or I'll print some off, try and remember to print some off right now, and we'll get those to you. Thanks.